members will now come to orders, 3:30 on Wednesday, February 24th. With us, we have Representative Book, Representative Lynn, Representative T. Wilson, Representative Holmes, myself, Chair Olson, and we have at least one more member in transit. We have a quorum. Please turn off your Blackberries or cell phones. Blackberries also interfere with the recording equipment. The first item on today's agenda is House Bill 342, and Representative Wilson, are you going to be carrying that, or do you have a staff member that will?
I have a staff member, Chairman, and her first one, so please be nice.
Oh, okay. Well, we're always nice.
I probably should have said that.
And I'm guessing that's probably Michelle.
Yes.
Please join us, and please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Michelle Sikma, staff for Representative Tammy Wilson.
Well, welcome, and we'll be gentle.
Thank you.
No, I will.
I was worried about her. Well, before the committee today is HB 342. It's a bill to extend the Board of Certified Real Estate Appraisers to June 30th, 2014. It's a relatively simple housekeeping bill that addresses the longevity of the board. The Board of Certified Real Estate Appraisers is a statewide board comprised of five members to establish one examination specifications for certification as a real estate appraiser, two to establish the rules of professional conduct to establish and maintain high standard of integrity in the real estate appraisal profession, and three, establish regulations necessary to carry out the purposes of the statutes. Present for testimony are Jenny Strickler with the division. She's the division's operations manager with Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. And I believe online we have Butch Olmsted, who's the incoming vice chair for the Board of Certified Real Estate Appraisers. And unless you have any questions for me, I'd like to introduce Chris Curtis, who's on here on behalf of Pat Davison, with the Division of Legislative Audit, and she's here to summarize the report given by Legislative Audit on BCREA. Okay.
Any questions? Representative Booth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Welcome, Michelle.
Thank you.
Will you be addressing the fiscal note on that, or will the representative from ECD be talking about that?
Through the chair, Representative Book, I believe that either Jenny Strickler will be able to or Chris Curtis.
Thank you.
Thanks again.
Okay.
That was painless, wasn't it?
Maybe.
For the record, I'm Chris Curtis. I'm representing Division Legislative Audit. We conducted a sunset audit review of the board, and we issued a final report this past January. And the objective of our audit was to determine if the board's termination date should be extended. We've included a little background on the board in the report. It got its origin from an act passed by Congress in 1989 called the Financial Institutions Reform, Recovery, and Enforcement Act. This act was intended to ensure that federally related real estate transactions had appraisals that were performed by real estate appraisers that had met minimum qualifications and were conducted in accordance with uniform standards. Under the Act, each state could establish their own agencies to license and certify real estate appraisers. So in 1990, the legislature created this Board of Certified Real Estate Appraisers. As a result of our audit, we recommend extending the termination date to June 30th, 2014, which is half of the 8-year maximum allowed in statute. And we recommend only a 4-year extension to recognize that the department and the board failed to address recommendations by the Federal Appraisal Subcommittee. So we make a recommendation in the report to the board and the department to address those recommendations. We also make two additional recommendations. One is to the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development to improve its administrative support to the board. This is a systematic finding in its problems with administrative support, and you'll see this recommendation in other sunset audits that we'll testify on because it's a systematic problem and it addresses all the boards. We also made a recommendation to the Office of the Governor to improve its timely appointments to the board.
Representative Lund.
You said they didn't implement or work on
I believe, two recommendations. Could you tell me what they were? Were those substantial recommendations or minor things should have been done? What was it they did not address?
Through the chair.
Is there a reason why they didn't do it?
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, the federal subcommittee that came under an on-site review, they looked at 42 applicants, and they retested the licensing, and they found that three of the 42 were not licensed in accordance with federal qualifications criteria. And so they recommended that the department request additional documentation from the applicants, and only one, the department went ahead and did that, and only one of the applicants responded. So they were also, the feds asked them to downgrade the licenses if they could not show proper support, and no action was taken.
To downgrade.
So the feds have come and done another review and have reissued those findings, and it's my understanding the department's working with the board to address those.
And so, if I may, you want to make the termination date less because they didn't address this in a timely manner, you believe, and is the quote punishment commensurate with the quote crime? Not a crime.
Through the chair, we decided that instead of waiting 8 years to come back and to review to make sure that the board is serving the public's need, that it may not be prudent to wait 8 years to maybe come back in 4 years to ensure that they're meeting federal requirements. In light of the result could be that they would not be able to issue appraisals, that any federal lending institution would not accept those appraisals if they didn't meet the criteria. It's fairly substantial.
And one, are there no inspections during the time that the board meeting? Any spot checks, unannounced visits to check records and other things?
By the department?
Yes, by anybody, by the department especially.
I don't believe that there's any systematic thing in place to, as far as oversight goes, except the federal review, and they are involved with fixing it right now with the federal agency.
But they have no ongoing series of inspection. I guess the problem is, you know, I'm retired Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
I served for a short time on the Inspector General,
mm-hmm.
and we did surprise inspections
mm-hmm.
all the time, and
mm-hmm.
rather interesting. Mm-hmm. And all kinds of things that required to do by regulation. And I'm just, it always amazes me in the government, we don't have the civilian equivalent of an Inspector General to go out and perform inspections on anything, it appears.
Mm-hmm.
I'd give her a new bill.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And we've been joined by, with Representative Chenault, or by Representative Chenault, so we almost have a full committee. Representative T. Wilson.
Through the chair, why not 2 years instead of four?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, a recommendation, you know, it's a bit subjective, and we tossed back different dates, and we thought that there was evidence, and we did call the federal agency to make sure that they were working with the department, and that it may take a while to address the issues. And there were some additional things that the federal agency is working with the state, some statutory changes, and that to give the agency time to make the changes, 4 years seemed like a prudent time frame.
Follow up, sir?
Sir.
Through the chair, so you don't think they could do it within 2 years? Changes?
They could, through the chair, they could very well. As far as coming back in to do a full-scale audit, whether that would warrant the resources, we didn't know if it was commensurate with coming back so soon.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Booth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Always intrigued by fiscal notes regarding issuance of statements like this program is required to cover cost of licensing fees, blah, blah, blah. No new funds are not required. I'm looking at a $100,000 note here per year. Could you explain what this all means?
Representative, through the chair, Representative Buick, no, I our purview, I'm sure Jenny Strickler from the agency could address the fiscal note. I am in tune with how they have to charge fees to support the cost of providing the service, but as far as any detailed comments on the direct fiscal note, I'm going to have to give that question over to the department.
Follow-up?
The only follow-up I had would be on how many times the board does meet and where and when this happens.
Through the chair, Representative Buick, we looked at 6 years, and they met 11 times. I believe they're required to meet at least once or twice a year.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
No further questions?
Thank you.
Ms. Strickler, welcome back. I think it's the first time this year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jennifer Strickler. I'm the Division Operations Manager for the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing in the Department of Commerce. It's a new title bestowed upon me last July. Prior to that, I was Professional Licensing Chief. Mr. Chair, to answer the questions of Representative Buick on the fiscal note, what that means is all professional licensing boards under the Centralized Licensing Act are required to support them their expenses through the licensing fees that they generate. And so therefore, the fiscal note reflects their average direct expenses from year to year. And that's the amount that the fees cover. It doesn't include indirect because the idea being that if you chose to sunset the board, indirect expenses, which is the division's overhead, would continue and just be passed on to another board. But the expenses shown there would go away because those are directly attributed to the real estate appraisers. We're not asking for new appropriation. We're just sharing with you what the average annual direct costs are.
Follow-ups.
Just looking at the language, Mr. Chairman, it claims that they're supposed to cover their own operating costs, and yet we have a bill for $100,000 a year. I understand that if we don't continue this, then we won't have a cost because they'll go away. But the language states that they're going to cover the cost. So it's still confusing to me, but I guess I'm no accountant. And I'll defer to the expertise of the department in lieu of this note. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'd like the record to reflect we've been joined by Representative Newman. Representative Schnault, I believe you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll try to enlighten a little bit. On the fiscal note, if you notice, the money is coming out of RSS, Receipt Support Services. So that is the money that they gather from the licensing costs, and that is how they pay it. It's not a general fund expenditure.
Okay.
It is just that's their receipt supported services that they provide.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, colleague Chenault.
It's always nice having a former co-chair of finance on a committee.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, another question. I don't know if she can answer it, but how many real estate appraisers are there in the state of Alaska currently?
Currently, there are 243 licensees.
Okay. Does that number go up or down on a regular basis, or is it stayed about the same?
Through the chair, Representative Chenault, it stayed about the same.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions? Thanks again.
You're welcome.
I might add, we've got Brian Olmsted, who's the on the State Appraisers Board, online for questions only. We also have Steve Turner, the past chairman of the Board of Certified Real Estate Appraisers, online for questions only, if the committee has any for either of those two gentlemen. And seeing no questions, we'll go to the public. Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Seeing none, is there anybody online? You don't know how easy you're getting off today.
Mr. Chairman, this is Butch Olmsted. I'm on the on the board. I'm the vice chairman for the Board of Real Estate Appraisers.
Well, thank you for calling in. Please continue.
I'd like to just to share with the chair and those concerned. We, at our last meeting of the board on the 19th, passed several changes to regulations that responded to the audit and the audit's recommendation. Additionally, we gave direction to the staff to follow up on two certified letters that had been sent to the applicants that had not complied with their continuing education requirements. In addition to that, we accepted a surrendered license for one of those three applicants. And as we read through the audit findings, we found and thought that we had accomplished what their recommendations was. And so going forward here, I think that the chair and the rest of the committee can feel comfortable that we've taken action.
So. Any questions? Thank you very much. Is there anybody else online or in the room that would care to testify on this bill?
There's Steve Turner here.
Okay. Fire away, Steve.
Go ahead. Yeah, past chairman of the Board of Certified Real Estate Appraisers. I think Butch pretty well addressed the concerns that you may have had questions about. I will tell you that the appraisal subcommittee audits visits the board every year and reviews their procedures. But this 2007 audit was a more thorough audit than they normally do. So they're here every year checking on us. They're not the inspector general, Bob, but they are checking up on us. And as far as the number of appraisers go, the number's up considerably over what it was back in 2003 and 2004 because there are a number of new, there have been a number of new applicants to the board or to the process. I believe there was maybe about 50 or so more now than there was then. Other than that, the way appraisers are billed, of course, our licenses are biannual, so every 2 years we are billed for the license, and that's one of the reasons I think the cash flow looks a little uneven, because I think in 1 year there's a surplus, and the next year there's the negative, and it supposedly the budget process addresses that. And I believe that's it. If you have any questions.
Oh, thanks again.
Thank you very much.
Is there anybody else online? Is there anybody else in the room that we care to testify? With that, we'll close out public testimony and bring it back to the committee. Representative Lynn.
A question. Through the chair to Representative Tammy Wilson, do you feel that extending to 2014 is appropriate, or would the 10-year extension, after what you've heard today, would that be more appropriate or somewhere between maybe 6 years instead of 4 years? Do you still think the 2014 is the best at this time?
Representative Wilson.
Through the chair, absolutely. If that's a recommendation, let's make sure everything's taken care of. It'll make everybody feel more comfortable. And, you know, I was more concerned that maybe 2 years, but if it's going to have an added cost and really no benefit, I think 4 years is fair.
Fine.
Any further questions? What are the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chair, I needed to slow. I may not need to, but better to over-disclose and under-disclose. I'm a current holder of an Alaska Associate Brokers, Real Estate Brokers license, and just wanted to disclose that.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill number 342, version /A from committee with any individual recommendations or attached fiscal notes.
Seeing no opposition, the bill will move out of committee. We'll take a brief at ease. Record, and the second item on the calendar for today is House Bill 346, Workers' Compensation Advisory Board, and presenting the bill will be Conrad Jackson from my office, possibly.
You may not be Mr. Chairman.
If he wants to keep his job.
Answer the question.
And before we let Conrad start, we have an amendment, and I would entertain a motion of, on the amendment for bringing it up for purposes of discussion.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer amendment backslash one, or backslash R1 for community discussion.
Mr. Chairman, objection. What are we doing?
Would you like to object for purposes of discussion?
I would like to object for purposes of discussion and ask what bill we're on and what amendment this is.
I think it's the only one at this point in time.
We're on 346? Okay. Amendment's right here. Got it. All right. Now I'll object for purposes of discussion, Mr. Chairman.
Please continue, Conrad.
I'll start now. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Good afternoon, again, to some of you. For the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Representative Olson. Before you today is House Bill 346, an act establishing a workers' compensation advisory board. Let me first try to go through just a little bit of the reasoning behind the bill, and then I'll explain the contents of the amendment, and we'll go from there. As I think all of you know from hearing House Bill 314 a few weeks ago, the Medical Services Review Committee met again a number of times last year. This is another one of their recommendations in the process of reviewing medical and related services in regards to workers' compensation. The report generated in November listed this committee as you see, or board as you see, before you in the bill. There was a lot of input, and this was our recommendation with a minor change. In the haste to get it drafted, the board was named a board instead of a council. So what we've done with the amendment is change board to council. Pretty basic. In addition to that, the other change you'll see on page 2 of the amendment, let me scroll down through, I believe it's line 18 and line 20, do away with the Medical Services Review Committee. They will be replaced by this new council. frankly, Mr. Chairman, that's the gist of the bill. We have the director of the Division of Workers' Comp online. I can go through, if the members would like, the members listed in the new council. I think everyone has probably looked at the bill, has taken a look through the sponsor statement, so I won't take up the committee's time by doing that. I'll answer anyone's questions.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Conrad, what is the Medical Services Review Committee? What's their job?
Representative Newman, through the chair, if you'll allow me to read, or the chair will allow me to read, the Medical Services Review Committee was put together by the legislature in 2005, and in 2005 they set out a new mission to assist and advise the Department of Labor and Workforce Development and the board, the current Workers' Compensation Board, in matters involving the appropriateness, necessity, and cost of medical and related services.
So make sure. So then, what I understand that they review medical services. So if a person is injured on the job, requiring some workers' compensation reimbursement or fee scale on a procedure, that the Medical Services Review Committee currently is that's who is doing it now. They look and they say, well, we're only going to pay a certain amount on that, or we don't feel that it's necessary, or how does that work?
Representative Newman, through the chair, the Medical Services Review Committee does not review individual cases on a case-by-case basis. If you are injured, they would not see a file on Representative Newman and your injuries and recommendations for any of the medical treatments. No, they would review things like the medical fee schedules, that type of thing. There's no individual case-by-case review.
And I might add, we have Trina Heikes, the director of the Division of Workers' Comp, online shortly to testify, so I think she can probably give you a good history. Any further questions? Representative Wilson.
Thank you. Through the chair. You handed some letters out to us and other people who want to be on this board.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about changing any of those around, or do you think it's a pretty well-represented area?
Representative Wilson, through the chair. During the course of the meetings, there was input from a number of affected parties. The Medical Association it weighed in. I believe testimony was taken. Discussions were held between a lot of affected parties. It appears at this point that the recommendations look to be, at first blush, pretty balanced. It's maybe not perfect, but there's a point, I think, as we've all seen, that the larger a committee or a council or a board grows, the less actually gets done. So the current council, assuming the amendment is passed and the bill, would be made up of 11 voting members, a reasonable number, we felt, and the Medical Services Review Committee felt. There's also a number of other ex officio members that will also provide input. The meetings that the new council will hold will be public meetings. There, I'm quite confident, will be many opportunities for the public in whatever capacity to weigh in and voice their opinions.
Thank you.
Yeah, and if I could add, it's taken us 4.5 years to get to the point that we're at, and I think a significant amount of the work was done in the last 6 months. Mm-hmm. Any further questions for Conrad? Representative Lynn.
Thank you very much. On page 2, line 4, we have two members from membership of the legislature, and I'm wondering if perhaps you should be representing the legislature from the two legislators receiving the highest number of, one Republican, one Democrat, but I don't want to limit it to that. Just say those who got, represent the parties who got the two highest votes in the previous election. So we make sure we have at least two different viewpoints from the legislature.
Representative Lynn, through the chair, it was the recommendation again of the Medical Services Review Committee that, as is the case with other appointments to things around the state, that the member from the other body, the Senate, is appointed by the President of the Senate, and the House member be appointed by the Speaker.
If I may, but what if two members of one party of the same party are nominated, one by the Senate and one by the legislature? Shouldn't they be representative of both major political parties? They do bring different perspectives. That's why we have different parties.
Representative Lynn, through the chair, that's certainly an option that could be brought up by the body.
Thank you.
I think the only place we've seen that recently is on the Ethics Committee. Is that correct? Yeah.
As far as I know.
Representative Newman.
Just on that point, I think I heard that a member from the House or the Senate who got the most votes in their district or their respective bodies or something. And I don't think I like that idea because I got the most votes in the House. Right? No, I think generally doesn't the Speaker and the Senate President generally do that. I think on most things that we do.
But shouldn't both parties be represented? I mean, regardless of who appoints them?
At this point in time, we don't know who the next President and Speaker are going to be. I mean, it could be both parties, but I don't...
No, I don't mean...
I don't think we need to mandate it.
I don't mean, Mr. Chair, the President and the Speaker. I mean, the person who gets appointed by these folks, shouldn't we make sure that both parties are represented?
I don't have an answer. I mean...
Representative Lynn, through the chair,
Representative Chenault was here, we could ask him.
I think that would be a policy call for the legislature, for this committee, and possibly for the full body.
Yeah. And I'd like at appropriate time, I'd like to get the viewpoint of other people on the committee here.
Representative Boog.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, if the sponsor would be amenable to a conceptual amendment from my colleague, I certainly wouldn't oppose that, but I would like to hear further comment.
Yeah, I think we need to talk to both legal and the committee and the Department of Labor. At this point in time, you can toss one out, but I think we ought to get a little more input on it. It was something that hadn't come up to us during the earlier stages of the bill. And I always get nervous when I see her with the blue book.
I like statutes, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions for Conrad? Thanks. I'm going to do something that's going to get me in trouble now. Linda Hall, would you come up just for a few minutes?
With or without the blue book.
For the record, Linda Hall, Director of the Division of Insurance.
What can you tell us about the history of how we got to where we're at? I'll be asking the same question of Trina, but what have we missed so far? Board makeup, on...
I think Mr. Jackson did an excellent job of discussing the history. I think there's a long history of different kinds of advisory committees, and while I'm not sure we've talked about it, there's some of the letters, and I believe your sponsor statement referenced the ad hoc committee, which I know was very active and did some really good work with coming up with proposals in the 1988 work comp reform. More recently, there seemed to have been some lack of ability to reach that kind of agreement and move forward with proposals. And so when the Medical Services Review Committee met and worked this summer, I did attend some of those meetings and watch their recommendations for ways there could be improvements and changes in the workers' compensation system. I thought they were good to try something different, because what we've been doing them the past 5 or 6 years really doesn't seem to have produced a good outcome. So it's something I have seen work in other states. I know Oregon, for example, while the committee composition may be a little different, they've had people come to Alaska and actually talk about their advisory committee that advised the legislature on workers' compensation issues. And it seems to me that a body with some statutory authority would bring a different level of, I guess I would say, credibility to the process. So I was very supportive of the composition, and particularly the idea of having this kind of an advisory council.
Representative Book.
I didn't have any questions for the director.
Thanks again, Linda.
Thank you.
I'm going to call on Trina Heikes, who's been involved with this probably to a greater degree than anybody in the last year. So, Trina, are you with us?
I am, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Please state your name and affiliation, and if you could give us a brief history of how we got to where we are now, it'd be appreciated.
Sure. I'll try to answer some of the questions that the members have as well. My name is Trina Heikes, Director of the Division of Workers' Compensation, and I want to thank you, Chairman, for introducing HB 346 and for scheduling it to be heard today. It's a much-needed piece of legislation. I am here today actually wearing two hats. You may not be able to see them because I'm up in Anchorage for Workers' Compensation Board meetings this week, but they're there. The first hat I wear is as the Director of the Division of Workers' Comp, and the second is the chair of that Medical Services Review Committee. And I mention the committee because, as you've been discussing earlier, this piece of legislation came out of those recommendations made by the committee members. We provided our final report, the committee did, this past November to the Department of Labor. And in that report, as many of you are probably aware, I believe we did provide copies of that report, the recommendations contained cost containment, but also the creation of this Workers' Compensation Council. As way of background, since about the mid-1980s, as long as I've been around workers' comp, there's always been an informal advisory committee that's operated in Alaska. And it was called the Ad Hoc Committee. And I call it informal because there was never any statutory authority. It just existed. And it was comprised of members drawn from organized labor and members drawn from the Workers' Compensation Committee of Alaska, which is an industry group organized to lobby for changes to the Alaska workers' compensation system. So out of labor and this WCCA, as we call it, the Workers' Comp Committee of Alaska, came the Ad Hoc Committee. And in 1988, this committee was very effective in making and proposing and getting through the legislature the huge changes that were made to our Workers' Compensation Act in 1988. However, since then, the committee has been unable to achieve any real success, and I think in large part due to the lack of adequate public input that such a committee obtains when it's operating without statutory authority. Those meetings aren't public. They're generally behind closed doors, and there's not a lot of public input. When I was practicing as a workers' comp attorney, I was involved indirectly in the ad hoc committee process as an attorney on the workers' comp committee, and we proposed many things, but they never got anywhere. The committee after 1988, as I said, accomplished very little. What did surface, though, was usually, and if it was proposed to the legislature, it did get passed into law, and I think the committee felt that part of the reason was that you had both labor and industry buying into that piece of legislation. But at least one prior administration, I think, ignored the recommendations of the committee altogether because it wasn't recognized in a statute. Thus, I think there's been a need for some time to formally make a committee for workers' compensation. In 2005, the Medical Services Review Committee, as you know, was created. And in looking at the medical cost and treatment issue this past summer and fall, larger issues loomed as well on the horizon. And we began looking at other states' councils and how they developed those. And we looked at about 10 Western states and how their councils functioned and how their legislation was drafted. And what we found, as Director Hall said, particularly in states like Oregon, those councils are comprised of labor and management, with the rest acting as advisory, and they work very effectively in drilling down into workers' comp issues and making recommendations to the legislature, because once it passes through that council, both labor and industry have kind of put their stamp of approval on it. Generally, these councils have met with good success. What we did was we looked at those statutes on the committee, and what this council is proposed in this bill is basically following, to a large extent, Wisconsin's model. I even spoke with their director, and I believe you have a letter from her as president of the International Association of Industrial Boards and Commissions, Frances Huntley Cooper, on how the Wisconsin model operates. We drew from that model. We also drew from Oregon and Washington and Montana, and as to authority, and came up with some recommendations that we thought would work good in Alaska. The intent of the Medical Services Review Committee was to gather workers' compensation stakeholders on a council like this who have knowledge of workers' compensation law and systems and who are willing to devote time and energy to transforming Alaska's workers' compensation system into a first-class system. That's generally the purpose and intent of creating one of these councils. The committee doesn't want people who are working for their own agenda, because committees or councils of that type generally just kind of end up going nowhere. Rather, you want people with a single goal of workers' compensation improvement in that system, which is getting the injured worker healed and back to a productive life as soon as possible, in order to minimize the impact of the injury on their life and the life of their family. Under this bill, the council is comprised of 11 voting, as you can see, and 5 non-voting members. 4 voting members were drawn from organized labor, 4 voting members drawn from various employer groups, and 3 voting members from various medical societies. The non-voting members are 2 from the insurance industry. Although they're not voting, their expertise, we felt, would be necessary in most councils. Well, in fact, every council that we looked had industry as a non-voting participant. Also, 1 from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, who serves as the commissioner's designee, and then 1 from each legislative body. Now, those states that have these, this in their model, the purpose is, and the intent of having 1 from each legislative body is so that the legislature is kept apprised of how the council is operating, what is going on, what issues they're looking at, so that it's not a big surprise when some recommendations come out. There was a concern about voting members, who should vote, and I believe you have some letters from organizations addressing that. I would say this, that the 10 or so states that we examined, only employers and employees were given a vote on the council. Doctors were members, but they were not voting members. This bill is different, and the committee's recommendation, albeit by a very slim majority, was to give doctors a vote. The bare majority agreed that doctors needed to have a vote, as it's essentially workers' compensation comes down to a three-legged stool, employers, employees, and because we're dealing with personal injuries, doctors. They have to comprise one leg of that stool. And this bill gives the medical community a vote on all issues affecting workers' compensation, something they do not have at all in Alaska outside of the Medical Services Review Committee, and something they don't have in any other state that we looked at. Our concern was that if you don't give doctors a vote, they're simply not going to show up, and they are a necessary component to educate and to move and educate on the system and to implement any changes that this council wants to affect in the area of workers' compensation. One other item of note is that the insurance industry is not given a vote, as I said earlier. Their expert assistance will be necessary. No other councils give them a vote. We recognize that while the insurance industry involvement is necessary, they really don't have a dog in the fight, is the reason they weren't given a vote. And as one member of our committee put it, who's from the insurance industry, she said, we don't have a dog in the fight, we just pass the savings on to you. Insurance industry did not want to vote on this council either, and that's why it's come down to these three groups, because those are the stakeholders in this council. In short, I think this bill creates a workers' compensation council, which has been needed in Alaska in a very long time. And through this council is hope of the Medical Services Review Committee and the department that we can garner more public input to a degree that we've never experienced before in Alaska when viewing and dealing with workers' compensation issues in hopes of improving our system. And I really urge you to support this bill. Thank you. And unless any of the committee members have any other questions for me, that concludes my presentation.
Well, I'd like to thank you, number one, Trina. Number two, what is your feeling on having a partisan split on the two ex officio legislative seats?
Chairman Olson, I leave that up to the legislature, if that's what you want to do. But in reality, all these members are doing is serving as a messenger, if you will, to the legislature to let them know what's going on, what big issues the council is looking at. And I don't know whether you need a bipartisan effort in that or you want that to be just a point that the bill currently provides. My thinking is that I'd leave it up to you, but recognize that it's just basically a messenger to keep the legislature aware of what this council is doing.
We don't look at party affiliation on any of the remaining seats, do we?
No.
Amendment number 2.
Any questions for Trina? Thanks again. We have several other people online. Kent and Brian, Property Casualty Insurance Association, are you with us?
I am there, Mr. Chairman, and prepared to testify if you're ready to hear from me.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you very much. My name is Kenton Bryan. I am the Northwest Regional Manager and Assistant Vice President for the Property Casualty Insurers Association of America. We're a national trade association of property casualty insurance companies, including member companies that write workers' compensation coverage in the state of Alaska. I'm here today to thank the Department of Labor and the Department of Insurance for their work and the work of the Medical Services Review Committee to put together the recommendations that were in the report and this legislation. Indeed, I think it's a well-known fact to all of you in Alaska that the employers in your state are stuck paying the nation's highest workers' compensation rates. And those rates are driven in large part by medical costs and the costs that are paid to help injured workers get back on the job as quickly as possible. In Alaska, medical costs represent about 72% of workers' compensation losses in the state, in comparison to the national average, where medical costs represent about 58% of workers' compensation losses. So you can see that medical costs are a large part of why workers' comp premiums are higher in Alaska than they are in other parts of the country. As we look at House Bill 346, first of all, I'd like to say that we support this legislation and, again, thank all those who worked on it over the past year to get it put together. I want to suggest that the committee might want to look at the makeup of the new council in this respect. And you've heard it mentioned, I think, both by Trina Hikas and by Director Linda Hall, the Oregon system and what happens there that's a little bit different. I want to spend just a moment on that because I, as part of my region, do some work in Oregon as well and am familiar with their workers' compensation system. Oregon's workers' comp system engaged in a major overhaul in 1990, and one of the really critical and shining results of that overhaul is that in the state of Oregon, employers have seen their workers' compensation insurance rates decline in, I think, every year but one, if I'm not mistaken, since those were enacted 20 years ago. By comparison, in the neighboring state of Washington, where I live, where we have a state-run monopoly, the cost for workers' compensation and the rates paid by employers have increased almost every year since that same time. And a very recent report by the state auditor predicts that without even higher rates or serious benefit cuts, the fund that is in place to pay for the injuries of injured workers will go broke somewhere in the next 2 to 5 years. So a dramatic difference between how things are done here in Washington versus how things are done in Oregon. I think one of the features that are unique to Oregon that I wanted to impress upon this committee today is the fact that there is an advisory board in Oregon, and it's called the Management Labor Advisory Committee. It's a 10-member committee, and it is made up of 5 representatives of organized labor and 5 representatives of management, of employer groups, or I should say employers. There is no tie-breaking vote, and there are no other entities allowed into the Management Labor Advisory Committees. Providers are not represented, and insurers are not represented. No other vendors are represented. It's simply the two sides battling it out. There's a tacit agreement, although it's not required by law, but there's a tacit agreement in the legislature and with the governor that unless a major piece of legislation relating to workers' compensation benefits or procedures or claims processes has the MLAC seal of approval, the legislature won't pass it and the governor won't sign it. This is a very powerful tool, speaking from an insurance company perspective, but I think also from both the labor and the management side, to make sure that there's fairness in everything that goes forward in terms of changing public policy related to workers' compensation claims and benefits. So as we look at the makeup of the council that's contemplated in House Bill 346, rather, I wonder if there might be some additional thought given to balancing out the current makeup of those who on the board, on the council rather, who are voting members. I don't want to suggest necessarily that insurers should have votes on this council. I heard what the previous testimony was in regard to why insurers weren't included as voting members. and I understand the rationale for the others who are voting members. So I don't know if that's necessarily the answer, although it makes some sense to balance that out a little bit by adding insurers, but I would not want to be seen just simply advocating that's the only way to go. But as we look at the current makeup of the voting members, you basically have 11 voting members. Four of those represent the interest of employers who are paying the bills. And the other seven, although not, I'm not intending this to impugn anyone's integrity, they might have a different interest in mind, either in expanding the benefit levels that are available to injured workers or expanding the amount of money that might be available to pay for providing for their care. And that strikes me as not the recipe for turning around a ship that's heading in a direction of having ever-increasing medical costs that are eventually borne, as was noted, not by insurers, but by those who pay for the policies. So if it is the will of the committee to consider balancing that board out a bit, and that 11 among those 11 members, we would be happy to provide some language that suggests a way to do that. If it's the will of the committee to consider adding insurers as voting members, we would be happy to provide language to do that as well. And we'll be interested to hear if there's interest among the committee in doing any of those things. But with those kinds of changes, we believe that we can wholeheartedly endorse this legislation. And as it is, I would say that we have concerns about it, but do wish to see it go forward. And that concludes my testimony, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thanks again, Kenton. Vince Beltrami, are you with us?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, well, you ready?
Welcome back. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Vince Beltrami, president of the Alaska FL-CIO, consisting of 60,000 union members statewide. And Chairman Olson, Vice Chair Newman, other members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to testify. And I'm testifying in support of HB 346, maybe with a couple of caveats, establishing a workers' comp advisory council. And I was one of the members of the Medical Services Review Committee. I was brought into the process a little late, just in the last 6 months, led by Trina Hykus. And we did have unanimous support for establishing a workers' comp advisory council, which was relatively consistent with what's been proposed here in HB 346. I think creation of the council will put into statute a function which, as Trina kind of alluded to, which the Workers' Comp Ad Hoc Committee has had limited success in trying to perform over the years. And by establishing this council and the way it's proposed, I think it will resolve some of those difficulties and conflicts that are encountered in the Ad Hoc Committee process. And it'll consolidate the function of the Ad Hoc and the Medical Services Review Committee. It should streamline issues with all the main players at the table in a construct that which properly should serve the two principal interests, that's the injured workers and their employers, and should eliminate any perceived or possibly real profit motive from the process. The Medical Services Review Committee looked at models, as Trina and the previous gentleman testified, in several other states, and is successful to most similar to the successful model in Wisconsin. And those other states in particular have had resulted in greater efficiencies for the workers' comp systems, both in reducing cost to the employers and in improving protection for the injured workers and setting policies that return injured workers back to the job more quickly. And, of course, that's the point of the whole, or should be the whole point of the workers' comp process. In terms of the makeup of the committee, I agree with the basic structure. At the Medical Services Review Committee, there was considerable debate about who'd have the right to vote. And as has been said, other states, the voting members are limited to labor and employer representatives. And a couple of our committee members, particularly one from the medical care providers, was fairly adamant about having the docs, having a voting right on the proposed council. And I didn't strenuously object to that, but I was concerned that other states had not provided for that particular circumstance and limited their voting rights strictly to the labor and the employer representatives. But I mean, I'm more than willing to hear the docs make their case, and I realize and acknowledge that the doctors are a key component of having a successful process that adequately treats the injured workers. I did have one concern on the subsection covered in lines 9 through 11 on the first page of the bill, where it talks about on the makeup of the employer representatives. It's as stated, it's conceivable that the oil industry could actually occupy all four employer positions, or any, well, the oil industry in particular, because they are named, as there are self-insured oil industry employers, and there's also general contractors who do nothing but oil field work. So accordingly, I'd suggest maybe amending that language to assure a more diverse pool of employers are represented. Now, I suppose the same could be said of the organized labor positions, and of course, I wouldn't be objectionable to language that diversified the organized labor pool either, whether it be, you know, a certain number of building trades or folks that represent people in the oil industry or other private industry or whatever the case may be. To Representative Lynn's point on balancing the political party participation, I certainly don't object. I might suggest, I know it's expanding the size of the committee, but an easy fix seems to be if you double the number of legislators to accomplish that equal political representation. However, I think by kind of the nature of this process that some of those concerns will be somewhat mitigated due to the fact that the legislative reps are ex officio, and as Trina said, they'd have a voice but not a vote, and the legislative members would primarily be advisory to the legislative bodies. But in concept, I strongly encourage the adoption of HB 346 with some clarifying amendments that ensure Alaska's injured workers will be treated fairly and in the most efficient way possible. And I thank you for the opportunity to testify today and would be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Vince, the one question I have is on the appointment process.
Uh-huh.
Under the bill as written, with the exception of the two legislative ex officio members, all of the members are appointed by the commissioner, that being the Commissioner of Labor and Workforce Development. Is that, and there's no other provision here for other other considerations, is that acceptable to you, or should there be any other provisions in there?
I think that's it. We had a bit of a discussion about that at the Medical Service Review Committee, and in the end, we thought the commissioner might, depending, obviously, a lot of it has to do with the administration and who's in charge at the time, but I think it would be possibly less politicized, coming from the commissioner as compared to possibly government or governor appointees. But I don't have any problem in concept with, and we all agreed, I think, pretty uniformly around the table that was an adequate way for representatives to be appointed.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks again, Vince.
Thank you.
We have one more person online. Patricia Wilson, are you still with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, please state your name and affiliation, and thanks for waiting for us.
My name is Patricia Wilson, and I'm with the Workers' Compensation Committee of Alaska. And the Workers' Comp Committee of Alaska did submit a letter that sets forth some of our positions on this legislation.
It's been passed out to the committee.
In agreement with this in concept. I mean, we don't have a conceptual disagreement with this council approach. I spent a lot of time at the Medical Services Review Committee meetings over the last year watching their process, and I was really very impressed by how the process proceeded and the work that they got done and the report and recommendations they produced. I don't think that we have a conceptual disagreement with the council approach, but the devil really is in the details. And in workers' compensation, the players are the employees, the injured workers, and their employers. And while there are other parties that have financial interests the workers' compensation system, everyone from vocational rehabilitation counselors to medical providers to attorneys. those folks aren't necessarily the ones who need to be the voting members in something like this council, because the ones who have the ultimate interest in the process are employers and employees. And I do think it's important to have expertise in various areas. I know, for instance, the Medical Services Review Committee took on some cost containment issues that involved very very difficult concepts and recommendations for cost cutting that required a lot of outside expertise and testimony. And I think it's that this type of a format allows for that, to bring others in that are subject matter experts as needed. And certainly I think that the medical community would be a valuable part of that. I do think that the voting members of the council should be the employers and the employees. Whether those members are appointed by the commissioner or whether the appointment recommendations come from outside, for instance, in the past, as Director Hykus mentioned, the Workers' Comp Committee of Alaska has taken on the role of being providing employer representatives, the management representatives, to the ad hoc committees that have met over the years, because the Workers' Comp Committee has members that have special expertise in workers' comp. Whether it be from the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce or some other type of business organization, I would suggest you look at having your management appointments come from a group that can draw from a pool of people that are specifically experienced in workers' comp. Let's face it, it's a fairly arcane system that has a lot of nuances that that many employers that would walk in off the street may not be able to immediately appreciate. So thank you for the opportunity to testify, and if you have any questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Wilson. Any questions? Is there anybody else online? Is there anybody else in the room that would care to testify on this bill? With that, we'll close out public testimony. I think I have to ask Ms. Holmes if she still objects to the
to the amendment. Mr. Chairman, I remove my objection.
Then at this point in time, we'll bring it back to the committee, but it looks like I'm running out of warm bodies. Brief at ease. On the record, we've closed out public testimony. We have the amended bill before us, and I'm looking for comments or amendments. Hopefully not, I won't say that. Representing T. Wilson.
Can we just move the bill? Would that work, sir?
It works for me, unless anybody has any comments. I'll entertain the motion.
Okay, I'd like to move House Bill number 346-26. LS1447/R with the amendments and fiscal notes.
Attached fiscal notes?
And anything else you want. And individual recommendations.
Please. Seeing no objections, the bill will move out of committee, and we'll take a brief at ease while we set up for the next bill. Item on the agenda today is HCR 19. Aid to report on in-state fuel storage. And Representative Rammers, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Speaker, and other members of the committee. I appreciate you taking up HCR 19, and I appreciate you dealing with our delay for those of us that were diverted to Sitka on Monday. Mr. Chairman, HCR 19 deals with in-state fuel storage. I'm going to try and be brief so I can provide the bulk of the time for Ada to speak. But, Mr. Chairman, if you recall, over a year ago, we were tasked by the previous speaker to work on a gasoline pricing report. We worked closely with Mr. Sniffen, who's here in the room, and one of the options that we looked at, apart from trying to incentivize or other refineries coming into the state to to add some competition for the production of gasoline was an expansion of the Port of Anchorage. At the time, the Port of Anchorage simply was not large enough to accommodate any additional fuel storage. Since that time, Governor Sheffield has physically enlarged the port by acres and acres with gravel. And the port is now large enough to accommodate fuel storage. And Mr. Chairman, there has been a great debate that I know that you have participated in about price gouging and price regulation here in the state of Alaska, and you and I share the same point of view on that issue. And so the idea today that is before you is for ADA to build a business case for the free market to do what free markets do best, which is to create competition. And in this case, competition would be allowing gasoline, diesel, and jet aviation fuel to potentially come from Cherry Point, another refinery that refines with natural gas and refines with 8-cent kilowatts, which would make the cost of various fuels perhaps more affordable to consumers in Alaska, because the rack rate over the last 16 months has been 60, 70, 80, 90 cents a gallon less than the two refineries that produce gasoline in Alaska, the Tesoro Refinery in Nikiski, the Speaker's hometown, which produces 85% of our gasoline, and the Flint Hills Refinery in North Pole, which is Representative Wilson's district, which provides the other 15% of gasoline in the state of Alaska, notwithstanding Southeast, which is served by Seattle presently and often enjoys lower prices than the remainder of the state. In this case, we're simply asking ADA to lay out a business case and see if it would warrant a third-party operator that would have the balance sheet to be able to assume the risk and liability and to bring in fuel from another refinery. With that, I'd be happy to answer questions, or I would step aside and allow ADA to make their presentation.
Any questions? Representative Wilson.
Thank you. Through the chair, how would this affect Flint Hills? Would this be a competitor to them?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, absolutely. That's the whole point, is to introduce competition into the marketplace for the benefit of consumers across the state of Alaska that doesn't come from price gouging and price regulation legislation, which would have a more adverse effect on Flint Hills than inducing competition. Competition makes us all better. That's the bedrock of the free enterprise system.
Thank you.
Representative Newman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ramos, was this part that I know that you really looked heavy into price gouging type of thing, was this a request that you did based on that you wanted to make sure that we had further information that drove this?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, terminal capacity was addressed on page 37 on this report, and we produced this in January of 2009. At the time, the Port of Anchorage simply was not large enough to accommodate the consideration of extra fuel storage. Governor Sheffield says that the port, in fact, now is ready, and he thinks that he could have the terminal ready for bulk fuel storage before the construction could begin. But of course, the risk for anybody who would enter into a transaction like this is they lower their price for Alaskans by 30 cents, and then Flint Hills and Tesoro come in and lower their prices by 32 cents, and then that fuel gets stranded in those tanks, and that's the inherent risk embedded in the free market. And just a final point is that we have talked to Tesoro and Flint Hills about this. Frankly, competition is preferable than price gouging legislation, which would run Flint Hills out of the state of Alaska.
No comment.
Follow up?
Nope.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
Do you have somebody from ADA you'd like to introduce?
We do, Mr. Chairman. Jim Hemsath is going to make a presentation.
Please join us, Jim.
Good afternoon, Chair. My name is Jim Hemsath. I'm Deputy Director for Business Development at ADA, and I'm here to testify, I guess, but Kaveda's background and how we see this opportunity for a business project. If Chair and the committee, if I'll just direct you to the presentation, what I'd like to do today is run through a few things and, oh, this is not good, sir. If you'll allow me.
Well, it's working on my side.
Well, that's the wrong presentation.
Oh.
It was one of those things. I said I got concerned, and I said I went down to Representative Ramos's office and said I'd like to copy a second copy on the thumb drive of presentation. And what they downloaded was the presentation from Monday, as opposed to the presentation from Wednesday. Specifically, I just made some structural changes so that it would flow better and match the one you hopefully have in your hand. Oh, much better. What I would like to do is talk about potential problem and opportunity as we see it, and where that might go. Talk a little bit about our planned way forward and how we might be able to address this problem, and talk a little about ADA and how and why we feel ADA can participate in a solution as it relates to the fuel system in Alaska. This is from a number of reports from the Department of Law and from Representative Ramos' report updated through 2009. Just giving you the price curves. On the top, absolute prices between Seattle and Anchorage. At the very end of the report, we have a similar one for Alaska and the state of Washington. It tracks very much the same. The bottom curve is probably the more important one, which does the math for us and gives us the annual spread between between Anchorage and Seattle. You can see historically it's been in the 10 cents a gallon range in the last 2 years, 18 months, moving up as high as $1 gallon differential, a dip mid 2009, and it's plateaued again at about 75 cents a gallon. It's probably fair without a lot of detailed analysis. I'll say qualitatively as opposed to quantitatively, that it's reasonable to assume that a price differential between the west coast of Washington and Anchorage and or Alaska should be in the 10 cents to 20 cents a gallon range, accommodating transportation costs, accommodating different efficiencies and effectiveness of the refineries, and that the 75 cents to a dollar might be more than what people might seem as being reasonable. Just a small graphic to sort of to indicate the transportation routes of fuel into the state, predominantly from the Cherry Point, the Bellingham area, by tanker or barge into Anchorage, from Anchorage itself or into the Nixisk refinery out, and to and from the North Pole refinery in Fairbanks to move a variety of distillate fuels, including diesel, ultra-low sulfur diesel, jet aviation fuel, and gasoline. So the way we see in this opportunity is that with these high fuel costs and issues of fuel security as well, and that part of that security also results in reliability. This past winter, there was a period of time that there was question whether there was sufficient jet fuel in Anchorage for planes to leave. There was a spike in the cargo load, and combined with a lowering of the production rate at Flint Hills, there was a lot of fuel coming into the terminal, and if I recall correctly, UPS supplied the fuel for Cathay Pacific, UPS picking up their fuel a little bit later date. So it was a little bit of a squeeze, and those kind of security issues are something that need to be involved in well. So what we see is a possibility or an infrastructure need, that there's something missing in the infrastructure itself that could alleviate a problem like this and provide an opportunity for economic development, or at least from the perspective of maintaining and saving jobs and opportunities in Alaska. And we believe that ADA, through its development finance program, can own and operate an asset like this to serve this need. But the question comes down from ADA's perspective is there has to be a business case. ADA is by law, and we'll touch on that a little bit later, required to have projects pay for themselves. We may have a lower threshold in terms of our payback, or if you'll use the expression investment needs, but still in all, we're required for development projects that we own that there be sufficient revenue to pay costs and debt. So when we look at the business case, we're looking specifically at opportunities for open access, whether it's BP, Costco, Fred Meyer, Safeway, AVEC, all people would have the opportunity, all organizations the opportunity to buy space and tankage and store fuel. It would be ADA-owned, but through a contracted operator, we'd have a contractor-operator manage the facility. As I mentioned before, this business case has to demonstrate that there's sufficient revenue in the project to pay for itself. And other things that we need to look at in the business case include the market and the market risk, where things are going, as well as addressing the issue of competition. There is that kind of a fine point where we don't want to be seen as being in the middle of competition as a state authority, although what we bring to the table is not necessarily a grant or something that's non-business-like, but there is that aspect, and we need to make sure that we're not putting one business out of business for the purpose of another business. We're not in that position of deciding. And of course, then economic development, job creation, diversification. Specifically, when we think about in the Anchorage area, one out of eight jobs relates to the airport. One of the key things in that car, especially that cargo area, is reliability. Not so much the cost, but the reliability of having fuel when fuel is needed. And we've got that. We've got the end of the slide here a little bit. Just we're going to kind of look at this as an open season approach too, in terms of where we're going. Is that we're not going to build on spec. The business case for us is that we build for a specific reason and a specific project.
We take a question from Representative Newman.
Thank you. Are you currently using a business plan like this or a business case? Do you have other business that you're involved in following this arrangement that you've got on page six?
What we have is as projects come into our office, we've got one looking now at a small iron ore mine in Southeast. Is we run through a similar process. Each project has its own mode, but basically the overriding factor is what is the business case, what is the revenue aspects of it, what's the market that this product is going to be sold to or used in, what are the risks in that market. It's similar. It isn't defined, I guess, as the, I'm sorry, through the chair, Representative Newman, it isn't defined in a stop-gap format. It is the way we approach the business and what looking at things. So, yes, sir, it's similar.
Please continue. Representative Wilson.
Through the chair, is there any other plan that you have that you are, as an entity, competing against private another private sector? I mean, this would definitely be a project that would be going against the private sector as of in Flint Hills. Are there other projects you currently have that is the way the business plan is?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, sort of. Is that sufficiently vague? That there is a matter of where you look at in our competition. The fact that at the Red Dog mine we own a road and a port that made that facility operate, does that mean that we were somehow competing with another mine in another part of the country? And the answer is we do compete. From our perspective, we're competing with other areas of the world and the region for jobs in Alaska. But as it relates specifically to Alaska only, we are not we do not have a project that is as potentially overt a competitor for the system that's there. And that's why it is something that we need to address and understand what those dynamics mean in the market.
Follow up, sir?
Yeah.
Could you tell me what the closest business plan you have right now that would be similar to this that you're currently doing?
Well, through the chair, Representative Wilson, the closest one would be our ownership of Ketchikan Shipyard. As there are other shipyards in the state in both Kodiak and Seward that do or can do similar work, although there are different aspects and different variations that make them not completely competitive, but there will be jobs that they may compete against.
Okay, thank you.
Please continue.
The product storage that we're looking at are the three grades of what we call distillate product, both jet fuel, both commercial and military. Again, looking at that fuel supply reliability, gasoline, it occurs to me that when I put three grades up there, I may have dated myself in terms of regular super supreme and unleaded. knowing that there are, well, my Tesoro pump has 3 grades on it, but there are variations, multiple grades in terms of octanes, in terms of the gasoline. And again, when we look at the storage, you also need to understand what the processing capacity is in the state and understand how the storage fits as part of their processing capacity. And then again, from the distillate, specifically ultra-low sulfur diesel and number 2 fuel oil, not only along the rail belt, but how it relates in the storage required possibly for Western Alaska. And what I have is that as a graphic there is simply from a 2007 report from the Energy Information Authority that just gave an indication of the amounts of sales in petroleum products in Alaska. And you can see that about 2/3 of that rely on jet fuel, and with the distillate and motor gasoline making up the other third. And while I don't know the answer yet, my suspicions are that the storage tanks will probably be sized somewhat similar to this. And the next couple of slides, just to kind of put things a little bit in perspective, is talking about crude oil yields. On the right-hand graphic is a light crude oil, typically of a West Texas intermediate, not quite an Alaskan crude. But in that particular barrel of oil, you've got 50 to 60% is in what we call atmospheric distillates, and about 20% is in the vacuum residue or the heavy ends. Alaskan currently is probably someplace under that, but not quite to the heavy oils. But I had these slides prepared, or this particular graphic prepared, up at University of Alaska Fairbanks. And this is where we think we're going with the crude slate when they start looking at producing some of the heavier, more viscous crudes on the North Slope, where the atmospheric distillates account for only 20% of the barrel, and the bottoms account for as much as 60% of the barrel. And the reason that's important is how a refinery deals with that. Flint Hills, the two Petrostar refineries, are typically light ends distillation only. So they're looking at that 20% of the barrel as what they're going to be able to produce product from. And their product is going to be what they call light straight run gasoline, kerosene, or nominally jet fuel, and some heating oil. In this particular cartoon, you see the hydrotreating is an aspect, and only Tesoro has a hydrotreater. The Flint Hills and the two Petrostar plants do not, so they cannot produce any of the low sulfur diesels. Tesoro moves a little bit down the curve with the hydrotreating for diesel oil. They have some vacuum unit capacity and some ability to make other gasoline products, but they're limited in terms of bottom destruction too, where a full quarter of their production is the heavy ends or bottoms that some refineries would destroy as a coker. They sell as a potential feedstock for other refineries on the West Coast, or sell as bunker fuel for ships. So that as the crude oil slates, the ability of the facilities in the state, their abilities to be able to produce predominantly that jet fuel, which is 2/3 of the market, changes. And that's an aspect to consider when we start thinking about fuel security and where the system is and how it might work. But more specifically to this project, and it is colorful, is just as a map of the port expansion as it is now. Where these fuel storage tanks would be in the red and yellow area on the far right of the facility. The yellow area right now has been filled. The red area is today open water, and that is on the schedule for the summer to begin the backfilling of gravel and moving of sheet pile to create that extra land real estate in the port. And that's important to keep in mind. While there is space and there is stage space, some of that space does not exist. It exists in the long-range plan, but it does not exist today. And what the port would be doing would be relocating their existing fuel offloading facility down to that area. So with that kind of a background and where we're going as it relates to this resolution, we say our action plan is this, broken down to 3 components. One is the market analysis. That currently is being done by Econ 1, and it's a continuation of last year's efforts on the pricing mechanism and being supported by the Department of Law. But in that market analysis, when you look at the military capacity, again, kind of lean towards the jet prospect, the long-term air cargo capacity in the state and the jobs, and the fuel supply reliability, what those things are there and the kinds of things that we need to have. Ada's in the midst of bringing on board an engineering contractor to do an engineering layout and estimate for us on this. And it's easy to say, well, gee, we could take a dollar per barrel storage right now, but the question is that how much storage is there and how much space is there? And as you remember back from that picture in the red and yellow area, we need to understand what our space constraints are. The market analysis may say we can tolerate a million barrels of storage capacity, but if only have room for 500,000 barrels of storage capacity, it could change the picture and change the business case. It's not just tanks, it's multiple tanks, it's vapor recovery, it's space for putting additives in to change Jet A into Jet 8 for military spec. It's the labs that are required in there, it's the significant amount of piping and manifolding to bring those fuels back to the area. And then combined with that, we need to understand what that schedule is in terms of the construction of the port. So I'd like to say it's going to be, we look at the market analysis, do a quick and dirty estimate, but there are so many variances in an estimate we need to understand a little bit better in terms of the business case that we're going to be looking at a little bit of engineering work. And then from those two areas, we'll establish what that business case model is, how it impacts the competition, what it impacts in terms of people's ability to produce fuel and how much fuel it might impact in terms of their sales, what the market risks are, and where we might indicate potential jobs, new jobs as well as jobs that might be retained because of this and depending on the risks. So why Ada?
I hate to do this to you, but can you wrap it up in the next couple minutes?
A couple minutes? Yes, sir, I can.
Oh, we're almost 15 minutes over. Not your fault, mine.
Just to summarize a bit, because I know the question is, and I'd ask the question is, well, why is this bill being written for Ada? Well, part of our mission is in terms of economic development and growth. We have that ability to own assets and in doing that treat them as a business entity, but with a different kind of a feel. And a lot of these slides are just background for you, but I want to get back down to why we think it's the development finance project. A couple of things here. One is that by law we have the ability to manage and operate projects as the authority considers necessary or appropriate to serve a public purpose. That puts this kind of a project directly in our laps. This is something that we can do. We also, by statute, are allowed and required to look at equipping, operating, maintaining facilities that will enhance the competitiveness of our international airports, specifically the Ted Stevens Airport. Issues on that fuel supply and fuel reliability are probably the number one risk to our air cargo business in the state. So these kind of excerpts from our establishing statute kind of drive us to be part of this project. This whole dense text says, yeah, it fits one of our project modes. But just to reiterate a thing, we're looking for projects from our requirement that have to be demonstrated to be economically advantageous to the state. The project is financially responsible and it produces revenue. We do have a business case we have to meet, and if the terminal aspect does not, this is not something that Ada can participate in. And these are similar projects that we've had, or large of our projects, the road and port up at Red Dog, the FedEx hangar here in town, the Ketchikan Shipyard, Skagway Ore Terminal, and we see the Port of Anchorage fuel terminal as one of the fitting into that mode, that we're looking at approximately 500,000 to a million barrels of fuel storage capacity. We're going to be treating it as an open access project. The project will be transferred by pipeline, barge, truck, and rail car. We believe that, and hopefully the studies will do that, this will actually enhance the statewide fuel system, which encompasses storage, distribution, as well as manufacturing. It will be done with a contract with an operator, and before we proceed, we use an open season concept for storage commitments. So to a certain extent, we've got to be able to guarantee that we have the business for a long enough period of time to be able to pay off the debt. And estimated costs, I'm on the high side here, but we believe, depending on the size of the terminal, between $75 and $100 million. And again, just in closing, you know, we feel that this kind of project fits our mission, and it fits our strategic vision to be that partner with Alaskans and a resource for the state in economic development.
Tammy Wilson has one quick question.
One quick question. On page 16, it says Ada does not compete with the private sector.
That's correct.
And this would compete with the private sector, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, maybe. The aspect is are the reasons for the distorted fuel cost, one, because there is strictly non-competition, or is there a fault, if you will, in the infrastructure itself? There would be more competitive fuel prices if someone was able to build storage, but any single individual may not have enough capacity to make the project economic. So who is that consolidator that's going to be looking at projects to bring other storage in town? Is it strictly competition? It may be, and that's one of the things we don't frankly know, but it could also be an issue of security. The question is, there may be a business case in this in jet fuel only, and it has nothing to do with whether we're competing to lower a price, but on the business case alone.
And with that, I'm going to hold the bill over, but I'd like to, while we're still on the record, I'd like to apologize to Ed Sniffen and Mark for not having time today to hear from you, but I've got a feeling we will shortly. But with that, we'll adjourn at 5:15, and thanks again.
Sure.